You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Well, I'm Tricia Cheel, and I'm part of a coalition called Stop Trashing Our Planet, and we've got candidates from Northland right down to Central Otago. So we're covering four health boards, and we're covering three mayors, it's Auckland, Christchurch and Central Otago, and also councillors and that on the west coast and in those other areas. And I guess our main message is to voters that, for me, I will never vote to poison you. My life has been blighted by so many of these totally unnecessary toxic additions to my food, to my water, to my environment. And I just feel that we need to take a serious look. 80% of chronic diseases have an environmental factor, and they've been overlooked, ignored, and it's time we did something about it. So my background actually is I was born in non-fluoridated Onehunga. I grew up in non-fluoridated Dargaville, and when I came down here, it was 1965, I went to Auckland Girls Grammar School. I was fine. And I did my sixth year up in Dargaville, and then I came down again in 1967 to Glendowie College. And it was really, what went wrong with me, and that's the year they fluoridated Auckland. Mm. And I didn't realise until the 20th of October, 2012, I'd been avoiding fluoridated water, but I suddenly stopped drinking it altogether. And I couldn't believe the difference. It'd been like I'd been walking through treacle all of that time, on and off. I used to collect rainwater from various times and that, but it did at least set me on the path of trying to find out what's wrong with me. So I went and investigated all sorts of things. I was actually enrolled at the Auckland Medical School in 1968, and as I say, people would say to me, oh, it's because you're a little fish in a big pond when you used to be a big fish in the little pond. But you know when you're brain is not actually working properly. And all of the symptoms that cleared up when I stopped drinking the fluoridated water are those ones that are causing a lot of people problems, the falls and things like that. I couldn't close my eyes in the shower without holding on to something because of the vertigo and things like that. So I'm really concerned that it's continuing to be defended, despite how many studies come out showing that it lowers IQ, showing all these other harmful effects from it. But so I went looking at all of these other, natural therapies, looking for some relief, and I finally ended up training as a classical homeopath in 1984, and I started setting up a practice in 1987 and tutoring night classes so that people would know how to use it in a home-based situation. And I was quite horrified to find that the same people would come to me with the same symptoms every time the council sprayed Roundup. Mm. And in my naivety, I thought, well, I'll go along and tell the council and they'll do something about it. And here we are, 30 years on? Mm. And they've used even more of it. Mm. And we've got 22,000 babies born in Auckland every year. And of course, they're the most defenceless and vulnerable to the effects of these things. So that's how I really got involved, and realising then that these people sitting on council had no real concept of what health and wellbeing and all the other and how our environment affects it and all that sort of stuff. So we that's how I started with Friends Issue 29 years ago now. Just my son came home and said there was a man with a flamethrower in the playground, and it turned out to be Rob Thompson, who had been poisoned while working for Takapuna City Council. He had no children, and he just decided that rather than let them, poison the children in the neighbourhood, he would do it with his little flame weeder. He trialled all sorts of things. He had pine oil concoctions and also very practical. So I thought it was good enough for him, it's good enough for the rest of us. We put 100 leaflets around the neighbourhood, we got 20, 30 people come out for the first working bee, And just slowly from there, we just took on more and more and more, because we said to council, well, look, if you can't find a way not to use chemicals, we will.
Mm.
And so we did, yeah, we did the trees, we did the park, we did 23 kilometres of roading, then we took the whole of East Coast Bays as a contract. And we were just bumped sideways by the hot water system. But we showed definitively that it can compete with the cost of Roundup and do a better job.
Mm-hmm. I'm definitely interested in touching more on all of what you just said. But I might just, before we deep dive into it, I might just ask what being a mayor means to you in your eyes, and why do you think you're the right person for the job?
Well, to me, the mayor's only one vote in the council.
Yeah.
But they do set the vision. They can keep the direction, the council on track, and as I said, with the, it looks at reducing the friction between competing interests, really, so that the council does stay on track with what they've been voted in to do. So that's, for me, is we need the mandate to make transformative changes. At the moment, all we're getting is band-aids. We're getting single bullet approaches, etc., etc. And I think it doesn't appear to have the all-encompassing thing to make the changes fast enough that we need. We've got, you know, a million species on the verge of extinction. And if that happens, we're punching holes in the web of life so that will no longer support us. Now, that to me is urgent. It will be catastrophic.
Yeah.
And I don't see that carrying on the same old way is going to solve the problem. My approach, I don't have all the answers, but I do feel that what I've been involved in, like Project Care, Project Rosedale, was to clean up the beach pollution in North Shore and upgrade the Rosedale treatment plant. We had a fantastic mechanism going there that involved everyone in the community, including the dissenting voices. And I think we need that. We need to get that collective community consciousness that work on these problems so they come up with solutions that work for them and their neighbourhood rather than something that's imposed from the top.
That's a really interesting perspective, I think, because something you mentioned in your questions you said to us is that one of your big concerns is apathy amongst the public and apathy amongst votership. How do you go about combating that and trying to get people more involved?
Well, I think that working at the local neighbourhood level, but of course the big thing is to lift the toxic burden off not just the living will, but the people themselves. And I know how fluoride made me feel. And we know that it's used in prisons, etc., where there are no children with developing teeth. If you look at it, we're not in the majority of nations using this stuff. And we've got to seriously look at not just the fluoride, but all of the other things we're doing that make people so crook that all they can concentrate on is putting one foot in front of the other and keeping their families together as best they can. We give out food parcels to the poor, and it's poor food. It's not food that's going to make them feel alive and wanting to be involved, etc. It's just food that helps them keep one foot and stuff in front of the other, body and soul together, but not that will, you know, enrich their lives or give them the vitality, etc., that they need to be involved in other things outside of their own personal circumstances. So the key to the apathy, to me, is the health and well-being factors being addressed. It's a total, comprehensive, ecologically sound, viable blueprint for an organic Auckland. Because if you're not feeling well, as we say in the thing, 80% of chronic diseases has an environmental cause. And when you have your health, you have everything. When you don't have your health, nothing else matters. And so you can't, sorry.
Oh, no, I'm just curious because, of course, the food that homeless people do get offered is not, like, a food parcel usually consists of canned goods, but white bread. But those things will last outside of refrigeration, and you're not going to find heaps of super healthy food that's going to be available and last a long time outside of those conditions. So what is the solution to get healthy food for the homeless?
I think that's back to this organic blueprint. So you look at the council, we no longer purchase things that are toxic. We no longer provide, you know, food that's not organic to all of the workshops, all of the things that... Every time I go to one, I say, oh, can I have organic food and non-fluoridated water? It's not possible. If they change their buying policy and make it so that we always go for the least toxic natural options, then that will start to make organic food more available anyway. It's going to start, you know, that turnaround to sort of say, well, in actual fact, your food is really important. You are what you eat. And we should not be giving people in need, you know, we should be actually giving them the best food possible. And if we put our minds to it, there's a very, very strong network of organic growers in New Zealand that just need that bit of extra support. We could also look at the government, say to them, you know, take the GST off organic food and make it more accessible to people. But that becomes part of our organic blueprint. The other point is that we need to be setting up, and it's again from the community. Every community is different, and so you've got to get those people in the community who have needs and those people who are willing to help, etc., and find out what the best way is to accommodate those people or the whole of you see, what we were working on is a catchment based management plan because your catchment is really the minimum unit of sensible management. Everything that comes out of that catchment has an escape point. That's the pollution that you can monitor. And if you set that up also, like our civil defence, we really need to future-proof all our communities with civil defence force headquarters that are equipped with rain collection, solar power, and also, why not make it a 24/7 crisis centre? Because, you know, children sleeping in cars are a crisis. Mm. It's catastrophic. And make sure we have gardens going there that are supplying good food and teaching people from there. You know, if it's a homeless family, for instance, may actually occupy that for some time. It could also be a centre for the carpooling, etc., that I think we need to institute immediately, because we're not going to solve congestion with infrastructure that's going to take years to build. We need immediate solutions. And in Christchurch, people there are saving $3,000 a year by carpooling. And I think it's never been properly trialled in Auckland. And one of the problems with it, that people are loath to go into cars with people they don't know. But if you've got a community base and maybe they've got a coffee stop there where they can, you know, stop and meet people before they go, you've got to have the parking spaces where they've got to be within walking distance of the local neighbourhood, and get that carpooling going. The other thing about the congestion is really that we should be looking at free public transport, identifying those most congested routes and where's the best place to offer free public transport. If you look at Oniwai Road, for instance, that's one of the real biggies. Just imagine if you, and even don't take the carpooling down that road, even give free public transport over to Northcote, so they can catch, you know, there's all sorts of, and it's a matter of asking the people in Northcote what they would use, not sort of dreaming up something and say, well, this is how we're going to solve it for you. if they don't want it, they won't use it.
there's certainly a lot to unpack in all of that as well. Yeah, but also just going to jump back to the homelessness in terms of you bringing up the civil defence. Civil defence force is used to treat natural disasters, obviously, or work to support people amongst natural disasters. Do you worry that potentially treating homelessness as with natural disaster strategies could be problematic?
There'd no doubt be some problems, but they could be ironed out if people took the view that we need to combine our income streams instead of duplicating resources and things. Because, I mean, civil defence mostly sits around, and I've been there, quite an exclusive little club. that you've got to be properly trained before you can, you know, really be much use in an emergency. And I think that's nonsense. I think at civil defence headquarters, maybe in every catchment, lower key, but involving as much of the community as possible. Because at the moment, as I say, to me, they've come across as quite an exclusive outlet, and we are the ones that know how to deal with a civil emergency, and you people will just get in our way. We've got to change that. We've got to change it to civil defence is something for everybody to have some knowledge of and how they best act. And if we've got centres there already putting those messages across, rather than just a once a year civil defence education programme or something, it's ongoing. Mm. It's ongoing. I mean, we need to secure a local water supply wherever possible. That's something that the Project Care Working Party sorted out, that, you know, everyone should be getting rainwater collection tanks. And they say it's just for washing and dishes and, you know, stuff like that. But there's no reason with a proper filtration system, etc., that can't be used for household drinking water. Mm. The reason that they didn't go ahead with that was that they wanted us all hooked on to paying for the Waikato pipeline, which, of course, now that was meant to solve Auckland's water shortages forever. So much water running down there, we'll never run out. And what did they tell us this year? Go easy on the water. You know, and one of the other things that we came up with that was urine separating toilets. And when I first heard, I thought, wow, what's that got to do with anything? And when I read into it, because we had the experts on tap, not on top. That's a big difference. You know, you need the people who know their stuff to be there feeding the information into these working groups or these, you know, community-oriented groups, etc., but not to be dictating where it goes. Explain to people. People understand, you know. If you take the nitrogen out of that sewage, you've got less to do at the treatment plant, and you've actually got a resource that you can on-sell even to farmers instead of importing urea from overseas. You know, it's just looking at that comprehensive thing that we've got to make those transformative changes. Mm. You know, that's the key. And so we can't leave any stone unturned. We can't, like, George Wood was mayor at the time, and he said, people would laugh at us. Well, no one's laughing now at our beaches are polluted again and things like that. We've got to be, and I don't think people laugh when they understand what may seem like a crazy idea actually does make sense. And they can see the point for overall for the future of their children. That's the bottom line, isn't it?
Yeah. I might just delve into the fluoride commentary now, because it is quite controversial, the standpoint you have. I think a lot of people listening might disagree with you on that. So the World Health Organization, in Tamaki Makaurau, we have the lowest recommended amount in our water by those standards. What do you have to say against what is an international backing of having fluoride in water?
Ah, it's not an international backing. That's what I'm explaining, that we are in the minority of countries doing it. And the other thing was about the WHO. I actually spoke a lot to John Cahoon, Dr. John Cahoon, who was the principal officer of dental health in Auckland for many years. And in 1981, he went round on a world tour to check on the progress of the fluoridation program. And when he came back, he actually looked at the statistics and said, well, teeth are improving in non-fluoridated countries just as much, just as fast, if not faster, than in the fluoridated countries. And we've also got the example of Anihanga in Auckland that's never been fluoridated. And the last, we should be actually following that referendum results, because they were the last ones to have a referendum on fluoridation in Auckland, and they voted 67% against it. And if Auckland Council had been open and transparent about it, that would have knocked fluoridation in Auckland on the head, because they say it's, you know, it's up to a vote, or they should have put it out to the wider population again, with both sides of the story being told. And what John Cahoon told me about that WHO meeting was, they waited until they knew the opponents of fluoride were out of the, you know, not actually in that meeting that they decided, and that was way back, to take the vote. And it's that sort of manipulation, devious manipulation, that's going on all the time.
Mm. I might, just to play devil's advocate here,
mm-hmm.
to say that internationally we are in the minority. True, absolutely.
Mm.
However, it might be more so that other countries might not have the infrastructure to be able to fluoridate water.
No, isn't that fair? No, that's not true. Like, Netherlands knocked it on the head because of Hans Muhlenberg and others who did the research and came back and said, not a good idea for the health of the nation. So it's not just countries without resources.
Mm. And then to follow that up as well, say you are elected and then you take fluoride out of the water in Auckland.
Mm.
If we see a spike in tooth decay, what do you then do to try and mitigate that?
Well, there's nothing stopping people if they still want to give their children fluoride tablets. They can. And I think that's the whole point. What's been tipped in the water is the filthy scrubbings of the phosphate chimneys of the phosphate fertilizer factory. It's not pharmaceutical grade at all. And in fact, when we asked Jonathan Coleman that, he wouldn't answer. When he was Minister of Health. So it's not just the fluoride that people are getting. They're actually getting a whole lot of other contamination with that that we don't need. You know, no level of mercury is safe, for instance.
Mm.
And all of those are coming in with this toxic industrial waste that we're putting in our water supply. It would be too expensive to put pharmaceutical grade in, I would think, anyway. But that's always... And, I mean, why give it to people whose teeth aren't developing? Because that's the, you know, that's the reason they say they're giving it to protect children's teeth.
Mm. Sorry, I lost my train of thought there for a second. Also, just on this kind of line of discussion of chemicals in particular, particularly when it revolves around a health context, everything is chemicals in the world. So obviously when that gets used in a health context, people can start getting a little distrustful about that word chemicals.
Mm.
How do you differentiate between what you mean by chemicals and just everyday everything is chemicals?
I take the view that anything that's synthetic, not been around in the natural world before,
but
it has the potential to be toxic and damaging, and particularly if it can't be returned to the Earth's crust at the same rate as which it's produced. Because if you think about it, it doesn't matter whether it's 5 years, 50 years, 5,000 years, or 50,000 years. Sooner or later, we will have a synthetic world, because you cannot keep turning nature into synthetic compounds. Now, the point with many of these compounds, and you look at the PCBs, etc., that they persist for a long, long time in the environment. Whether they're ever broken down, we don't know. We know what the fluorocarbons did to the ozone layer, and they're still going to be floating around. We've got these chemicals from Antarctica and polar bears in Antarctica right down to the Kermadec Trench, right up to the top of the Himalayas, etc. These persistent chemicals are there. And to me, the bottom line is, why use a toxic compound or chemical or substance or a toxic practice if you don't have to? And I think that's the key to it, because no one in their right mind would use a toxic chemical if they didn't have to. Mm. And we've proven, as I say, beyond a shadow of a doubt, you do not need to use Roundup on our streets. There's a $400 million lawsuit in America, and Robert F. Kennedy was, you know, part of the people that brought that. And he's, you know, adamant. There's about another 5,000 to 9,000 in the wings of lawsuits there that it is a carcinogenic compound. The IARC report said it was a probable human carcinogen. And it was Monsanto, a company that Monsanto had paid $500,000 with, that the person from there actually headed another committee to try to debunk that based on Monsanto science, tobacco science, you may as well call it. And our EPA listened more to that than they did to the IARC report. So we are still poisoning the whole of Auckland, apart from little patches, with a carcinogenic compound. And there's 147 chemicals at the moment waiting in the wings to be registered. And I know that, you know, people say, oh, we're all chemicals, but it's a matter of nature's evolved over millions of years, right? And there's no way that it's going to be able to accommodate that massive pour. And it's not as if it's at a sort of a steady level. It's a massively increasing in amounts and varieties. And the safety studies may be done on one single thing. Mostly they're not satisfactory safety studies on even one chemical, let alone when you get two together, three together, or the 300 that women expose themselves to almost every day in their household cleaners and their cosmetics and their washing, laundry and all that sort of stuff. And it's so those, you know, the combinations and permutations are astronomical, and they're not been looked at. They've just been glossed over. But why have we got the tremendous increase in autoimmune diseases? Mm. Why have we got the highest rates of cancer, motor neurone disease, etc.?
Well, I do just kind of want to jump to that a whole commentary about fluoride being synthetic, because fluoride is naturally found in groundwater, and then you add more fluoride in to make sure it meets standards by the World Health Organization. So I just find it interesting that you say synthetic, but then this is an actual natural compound that you're very heavily advocating against.
Hydrofluorosilicic acid is not a naturally occurring compound. Mm. The naturally occurring compounds of fluoride are, you know, more calcium, and the sodium fluoride is actually a cockroach killer. That's what it's used for, or was used for. So you're confusing what's a naturally occurring compound with what is a manufactured industrial waste, basically, and it's got a whole lot of other stuff with it, right? Mm. Fluoride is actually a very toxic substance, and the point is that's what human breast milk it's filtered out of, and there's a reason for that, is because babies are even more susceptible. So nature's got a way of dealing with the naturally occurring one. They keep it away from, you know, little human beings who are most susceptible. But it doesn't have much of a defence against the synthetic artificial fluoridation, which is what, well, most countries use. Mm. So, and also, it's very interesting. I had a student staying with me going to Massey University, and he was studying nutrition, etc., and sports nutrition and stuff like that. And I said, oh, what do they tell you about fluoride? Mm. And he said, well, there's two books, and one says it's necessary for human nutrition, and the other said there's no studies proving that it is. And I said, oh, have you brought that up with them? And he said, no, just wants to pass the course and go on and get a job. And he said, but the interesting thing is that those two books were written by the same person. Hmm. And I'm going, what's happened to academic honesty, integrity, the urge to investigate and spread, you know, honest information out there, when you can write two books telling quite opposite?
That is a very interesting perspective to have at the minute, because we are in an age of extreme levels of not
tobacco
necessarily
science.
Fact. Well, just it's so much information, and it's not always viable. Mm. It's not always truthful, and sometimes it's backed by negative people. I guess my question to you with that in mind is, how do you know your information is the right information?
Well, I think I've got a certain level of scientific understanding. I mean, that's where I originally started as a scientist, and I think science is a really great tool, but it's a really bad master. And I actually put my trust in other people who, like Paul Connett, for instance, who's a professor of chemistry. He knows his stuff. And he thought, same as me, go along to the local council and explain the chemistry of it and be gone by lunchtime. And 7 years later, he's still trying to get that message through. I mean, for me, it's 30 years later. And it is reliable scientists that are you know, putting that counterview. I mean, that last study that came out, they said, oh, it's just one study. It wasn't. There's about 34 at least that links fluoride with lowering of IQ. And people then will say Professor Gluckman's report, you know, said it's perfectly safe, etc. What Professor Gluckman doesn't do is go back and amend his report when it was pointed out to him he'd made a glaring error, that it was significant IQ points. Mm. He should have gone back. He acknowledged that he'd made a mistake. He should have gone back and corrected it and put it, you know, out to the public that, in fact, it was significant IQ points that these studies were talking about. Why? These sacred cows, they cling on to them so tightly, whether they're doing damage or not. It concerns me. So I look at as much as I can from the information, but for me, of course, I've got my own personal experience.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.